Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen from New Orleans, Louisiana, welcome. The Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, was on Face the Nation this weekend, the CBS Sunday Yak Fest, and she said the reason the administration opposes the congressional Democrats' attempts to place a timetable for withdrawal on American troops in Iraq, you've heard we're there, right, is that it would deprive the administration of needed, quote, flexibility and creativity, unquote. You see, that's the problem with the whole Iraq thing. We haven't had enough creativity. People haven't been making enough stuff up. So we need more creativity. The first person convicted from Guantanamo Bay, the first person who actually pled guilty, brought charges were brought against him. He's pled guilty. David Hicks. He's out of the news in America for, you know, considering the fact that he ever was in the news. He was in the news for one day when he pled guilty. But there's news from Australia about who, in fact, and what he was. Australia's Attorney General now says David Hicks appears to have, quote, diminished capacity. That's a nice way of saying, you know, a couple six-packs short of a case. Attorney General Philip Ruddock said training with terrorists was a serious matter, even if he had diminished capacity. And Ruddock added that training with terrorists wasn't an offense under Australian law at the time Hicks was undertaking training in Afghanistan, but it was now, much like the charge to which he pled guilty, providing material aid to terrorists, which was not a crime in American law when Hicks was in Afghanistan, but was by the time he pled guilty to it, don't you know? The Australian government's portrayal of Hicks as a dangerous terrorist, though, has been torpedoed by his U.S. military prosecutors. U.S. military prosecutors. They have described Hicks as a bumbling wannabe who would have been a, quote, total liability for al-Qaeda in any terrorist attacks. The prosecutors, in a scathing critique that's coming out in a new book quoted in this weekend's Australian, owned by Rupert Murdoch, prosecutors have described the convicted Australian as a man of, quote, no personal courage or intellect, unquote, who rolled over as soon as he was questioned. They have undermined the Australian government's portrayal of him as a dangerous terrorist by admitting his crimes were relatively minor compared with those of fellow inmates at Guantanamo Bay, says John Altenberg, the top U.S. official in the Office of Military Commissions from 2004 to last year, speaking publicly about Hicks for the first time, quote, I think he read Soldier of Fortune magazine too many times. His case was a very ordinary case. There was nothing special about it in that he was clearly but a foot soldier. For people wanting to see the worst of the worst, this was not going to be it, unquote, the U.S. prosecutor. That's the first guy we get up on charges at Guantanamo. And, according to the book, it was Vice President Dick Cheney and former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld who refused to allow Hicks, the bumbling foot soldier with diminished capacity, to be released from Guantanamo Bay. The book quotes Australian intelligence sources as saying, quote, Hicks talked to everybody, anybody who'd come in with a hamburger, that he'd tell them whatever they wanted to know, unquote. Well, it's creative to think of bringing in a burger. Ladies and gentlemen, the story last week about, or a couple weeks ago, about the possibility that cell phone towers were responsible for the disastrous drop in the population of honeybees. Apparently, that's being knocked down. From the San Diego desk, this relayed from a beekeeper, quote, I found the cell phone stories fairly amusing, considering that this problem has been documented for at least 100 years. Cell phones are obviously not the cause. According to bee publications in my collection, this is not me talking, which date from the 1800s, disappearing disease, as it was called then, has existed at least since the 1890s. He fingers a pathogen called Nosema as the possible cause. But don't put your cell phone down yet. And we have to fight them there so they don't come here. A State Department report on terrorism due out this week will show a nearly 30% increase in terrorist attacks worldwide, last year, almost all of them due to growing violence in Iraq and Afghanistan. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and her top aides earlier this week had considered postponing or downplaying the release of this year's edition of the yearly State Department terrorism report. Ultimately, they decided to issue the report on or near the congressionally mandated deadline. What a nice thing. They're meeting the deadline that the Congress set. That sort of tells you what they do with the congressional deadline for troop withdrawal, doesn't it? And if we're fighting there so they don't come here, and leaving a failed state would provide a haven for terrorists to set up a headquarters, what are we to make of the fact the New York Times reported this week that al-Qaeda's headquarters is in Pakistan? Hello, welcome to the show.
Shapiro got his law degree. He moved to Brooklyn from Schenectady, 93. Got some clients in the food industry. He says it's not the money, it's the recipes. He calls his mom, says he's doing fine. She's got somebody on the other line. Puts Coldplay on.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this week's edition of the show. And folks down here are so grateful, ladies and gentlemen, in case you don't get that information, so very grateful for, well, just an example of what's to be grateful for. The United States government, according to today's Washington Post, was turning down many international countries' offers of manpower, supplies, and expertise worth millions of dollars in the wake of the flooding of New Orleans. The United States would also fail to collect most of the unprecedented outpouring of international cash assistance for victims of the flooding and of the storm along the Mississippi coast. Allies offered $854 million in cash, and in oil it was to be sold for cash. Only $40 million has been used so far for disaster victims or reconstruction. Most of the aid went uncollected, including $400 million worth of oil. Saddam would have sold it. Some offers were withdrawn or redirected to private groups such as the Red Cross. Thanks for that. The rest has been delayed by red tape and bureaucratic limits on how it can be spent. Because we're going to cut the Red Cross. That's what we're going to cut. Cell phone systems, we wouldn't have needed those. Medicine and cruise ships, we wouldn't have needed those. Were delayed or declined because the government could not handle them. In some cases, supplies were wasted. So we're grateful down here. We're not, no, come on. We feel so much a part of the whole deal down here. But you're welcome to come down. Because it is for, ask any of the visitors who are here. This is the first weekend of Jazz Fest, I'll tell you. It's pretty good. Pretty good for an area that was flooded by federal malfeasance for 6 weeks, and then the international aid was mishandled or unhandled. Because it's the grown-ups. Ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Oh, so much we don't know this week. One of Paul Wolfowitz's two hand-picked deputies, Juan Jose Daboob. I could just leave it there. Juan Jose Daboob tried to water down references to climate change in one of the World Bank's main environmental strategy papers. This is according to the Financial Times. Mr. Daboob, a conservative former finance minister from El Salvador, was brought into the bank by Wolfie. Wolfie's already under fire for allegedly trying to remove references to family planning in the bank's assistance strategy for Madagascar. The new claim will add to disarray at the highest ranks of the bank, which is in turmoil over Wolfie's getting his squeeze, a big promotion, and a big fat tax-free pay raise. The chief scientist of the World Bank says Mr. Daboob tried to dilute references to climate change in the Clean Energy Investment Framework, a key strategy paper presented to the bank's shareholder governments at its annual meeting in Singapore last September. Quote, he tried to water it down. He tried to take out references to climate change, unquote, Mr. Watson. Two other officials confirmed this account. DeBoob tried to remove some references to climate change completely, and in other cases, replaced them with phrases climate risk and climate variability. He thought climate change induced by human efforts was a theory and was not proved yet, said Watson. He said that went completely against bank policy. He and other managers in his division pushed back and insisted on some references to climate change in the paper. He said Mr. DeBoob conceded sufficiently to make the strategy paper credible. Mr. DeBoob, it's a gift. Attention, Chicago. The British government has been accused of covering up a $1 billion, black hole in the finances for the London Olympic Games when Britain submitted its bid. Look out, Chicago. Aides in the government were told by accountants 2 months before the bid's submission and 10 months before London had been chosen that the estimated bill for the Olympics of £3.4 billion was significantly short of the mark. The consultants warned aides in September 2004 that the bill was going to be £1 billion, $2 billion more than expected. In the event, even that figure proved hopelessly over-optimistic. The revised bill this year has mushroomed to about $18 billion, nearly four times the original $4 billion estimate. A spokesman for the Culture Department says, "It's nonsense to suggest we're being anything other than open as possible on the Olympic costs." She said the department had anticipated about $1.5 billion from the private sector that proved not to be forthcoming, and that therefore public funding had to make up the difference. Well, that damn private sector. When it don't come through, you know, it don't come through. But wait, there's more news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, come on. Got to be more. From Radio Free Europe. Hey, we own that. The record of Afghanistan's government was questioned this week at a high-level international conference in Brussels. This is our Afghan allies. The message of several key speakers was that Afghanistan's democratically elected government may be turning into an impediment to progress. Richard Holbrook, former U.S. diplomat and peace broker in the Balkans, told the gathering, "The Afghan government is walking away from democracy," that's a quote, "and losing its authority." Says he is now more concerned about the weakening of Hamid Karzai's government than he is by Taliban fighters. See, what we need is some creativity there. Oh, we have it. He said Karzai's government has lost momentum and transparency. Boy, I know the feeling. And that its erstwhile supporters in Afghanistan are being alienated. The alienation, he says, of some of the best and brightest Afghans who had supported the government are now fed up by it is a fundamental problem. And finally, in news, oh no, we have two now. On the health tip from outside the bubble. Do you remember, ladies and gentlemen, when there was concern in this country, way back when, about the possibility that homes or schools too near to high-tension power lines was a contributing factor to diseases, among them childhood leukemia? That's sort of been shunted down the memory hole, but here it pops up again in the British newspaper The Guardian. Banning the building of new homes and schools within 60 meters, what's a meter, of power lines is, quote, the best available option for reducing deaths from childhood leukemia and possibly other diseases. That, according to a report from a government advisory group. It falls short of recommending this as government policy because of fierce disagreements among members. Such a policy would have a dramatic effect on property prices within power line corridors. The cost of restricting development is put at £1 billion. Some members of the group that put the report together were very unhappy with the tepid nature of the conclusions, says Professor Dennis Henshaw, an expert on the health effects of power lines at Bristol University. The report is deeply flawed. He believes the scientific evidence for effects of power lines on health is compelling and wanted the report to recommend an immediate moratorium on building close to power lines, followed by legislation prohibiting it. Says Michael Jane of the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, also with the group, the government should take precautionary measures in order to ensure that the health risk is minimized. Some of the other members of the group, however, included representatives of the electricity industry and from the British newspaper The Independent. Now, Now that cell phones have been ruled out probably as the cause of the die-off of honeybees, let's look at Wi-Fi. The health risks posed by Wi-Fi technology should be investigated by eminent scientists to ensure that a generation will not be damaged by growing levels of, quote, electronic smog, unquote. The research hasn't been done. Therefore, we cannot assume there are no effects, says the self-same Dr. Dennis Henshaw.
What?
Yeah. I would be in favor of an inquiry into the dangers of Wi-Fi. This technology is being wheeled out without any checks and balances. His concerns were echoed by Alan Preece. Not Alan Price. Alan Preece, professor of medical physics at Bristol University. It's a whole gang of them at Bristol University, apparently. He's a pioneer of the research into the effects of mobile phones on the brain. Quote, no one is really aware of what we are dealing with high Wi-Fi, he says. These developments came after a week in which a row has flared between scientists around the world, prompted by reports in last week's Independent on Sunday that unions and scientists have been pressing for an official investigation into the potential risks of Wi-Fi. Professor Lawrence Challis of the Government's Committee on Mobile Phone Safety is also urging caution. Since we advise that children should be discouraged from using mobile phones, well, that's working out well. We should also discourage children from placing their laptop on their lap when they are using Wi-Fi. What's he saying? I think I know. Dr. George Carlo, chairman of the Science and Public Policy Institute in the United States, is setting up a global registry of people suffering from symptoms relating to the technology. He says there's enormous pressure from the mobile telecommunications industry, and the official stance taken by the government is different from the head of the Health Protection Agency's personal views. The agency has dropped the ball in not requiring testing before Wi-Fi goes into schools. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Who knows? Maybe they know. I don't. News from outside the bubble, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. A couple other items. Well, one from the scientific file that's odd. From the New Scientist, the iconic British robin is being forced to sing at night in urban areas because the daytime noise from traffic is drowning out his mating serenades, say scientists. Richard Fuller at the University of Sheffield and colleagues visited 121 sites in and around the city of Sheffield. That's a noisy city. When the researchers compared background noise levels at the different sites, they found it was 10 decibels higher in those places where robins were singing at night. Lucky they don't have any robins at Guantanamo. You know, where they play the heavy metal music all night? They wouldn't know when to sing. He doesn't know whether the birds that sing at night are vocal in the daytime, too. They could be having trouble attracting a mate. The nighttime singers could be sacrificing other activities such as feeding and preening. There's a possibility these are unmated males that are really struggling. Could be in their best interest to sing as much as they can. Female robins judge the quality of males based on how creatively they sing. See, Condi, there's where creativity is needed, with the robins. It could be that noise pollution is having a negative effect on all but the best males. Well, then you'd get better robins, wouldn't you? If this evolution thing works out. Speaking of which, have you noticed that the only time that conservative Christian Republicans approve of evolution is when it applies to Governor Mitt Romney's position on policy issues? They've evolved. Several attitudes already have shown that urban noise is causing city birds to change the characteristics of their song. A study last year showed that birds across Europe sing at a higher pitch to avoid being drowned out by the low-frequency din of traffic. Other birds just sing louder. In fact, in Germany, some nightingales sing so loud they break European sound pollution regulations. No reports yet as to whether they've started arresting the nightingales. You know, man's doing a great job at the whole at our dominion over the earth, aren't we? And this just to put a kind of a different light on what big government does. You know, every time that there's a call for regulation in this country, particularly on worker safety or on food safety, a certain element of the political population says, oh, that's more big government, that's more socialism, that's more big government. So how is China, the home of big government, handling the tainted food situation? Hundreds of babies fell ill in an eastern Chinese province in the last few years. Quality control and product safety regulation are so poor in China, according to the Washington Post, that people can't trust the goods on store shelves. Until now, the problem hasn't received much attention outside of China, but consumers everywhere have been learning about China's safety crisis because of pet food. Chinese authorities acknowledge the safety problem and have promised repeatedly to fix it, but the disasters keep coming. There was a baby who became sick because of fake milk powder. 13 died, says that mother. I don't trust the food I eat. I don't know which products are good, which are bad. China is playing an ever larger role in supplying food, medicine, and animal feed to other countries. China is already the world's number one exporter of fruits and vegetables and a major exporter of other food and food products. China is especially poor at meeting international standards. Each month, the U.S., which only inspects a small fraction of food imports, rejects 200 shipments from China, mostly concerns about pesticides and antibiotics. Border inspectors in February, blocked peas. These would be peas in February, tainted by pesticides, dried white plums, containing banned additives, pepper contaminated with salmonella, and frozen crawfish that were filthy. Ladies and gentlemen, we got crawfish in Louisiana. They're pretty good, pretty damn good. Since 2000, some countries have temporarily banned whole categories of Chinese imports. European Union will not take Chinese shrimp. Shrimp, you know why shrimp? Because of banned antibiotics. Japan blocked tea and spinach, citing excessive antibiotic residue. South Korea banned fermented cabbage after finding parasites in some shipments. Hey, you know, parasites are like truck drivers. If they eat it, it's got to be good. As globalization of the food supply progresses, the food gets more anonymous, and gradually you don't know where exactly it came from, and you get more vulnerable to poor quality, says Michael Kaiser, director of the Center for World Food Studies in Amsterdam. Chinese authorities concede the country has many safety problems, have claimed other countries' assessments of products are sometimes not accurate. That's that big government at work, ladies and gentlemen, in China. This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, in case you're wondering why some people don't really yet trust the reassurances that how clean and safe nuclear power is, here's a story. This came into the news last week in the UK. Sellafield, which is Britain's first, and I'm not sure if it's the largest, but it was the first big nuclear power center for, you know, not bombs, not, you know, not like North Korea, but for power. Well, they found out that a lot of the workers there over the years had plutonium in their bloodstreams. And the way they found out about this is by taking little bits of the workers' bodies after they died and running tests on them. There was some controversy in Britain as to how much of their bodies they took for the testing and about the fact that they did this without either asking or telling the next of kin that they were poking around in the remains. So that was the center of the controversy, you know, the ick factor. But here's a spokesperson for the British government's nuclear health agency, talking to a BBC reporter about just exactly what it was they were doing.
In layman's language, was this an attempt to discover whether exposure to plutonium was causing cancer in people who worked in Sellafield?
No, nothing to do with that at all.
What was it trying to do?
For plutonium workers, we try and assess levels of exposure by taking urine samples. When you know how much is excreted, you can work back to the quantity which is in the body. The only way to test the accuracy of that is then take, for example, small quantities of tissue at autopsy to see how much activity is in that sample. Talking about samples of a few grams, you're not talking about organs or anything like that at all. I'm talking about very small samples. Can use that to assess how much was actually in the body at the time of death and compare it with what you'd estimated during life from urinary excretion samples.
But presumably the reason you want to test plutonium levels is to find out what effect they'd be having on the health of the workers.
No, it's to find out how much plutonium is in them. You want to know how much plutonium is in the body because there are a set of limitations on the amount of activity workers can have within their body, and you want to make sure that your workers are below those levels.
For health reasons?
It's a health and safety procedure, yes.
Which was my point.
Well, she had to be treed, didn't she, before she admitted it had a health thing. That may reassure you. I don't know. I don't know you. Ladies and gentlemen, there were a number of events this week that impinged on the mood, perhaps, of President George W. Bush. One of them was his father's appearance on Larry King Live this week, in which George H. W. Bush said, in his opinion, the country may be fatigued with his son. Maybe a case of Bush fatigue. That's what he told Larry King. Didn't comment on the possibility of King fatigue, but he said Bush fatigue. Then Rupert Murdoch told an audience of business leaders that the press is routinely unfair to George W. Bush and the president doesn't seem capable of defending himself. Quote, I do believe he's a bad or inadequate communicator, Murdoch said. He says, personally, Bush is persuasive, strong, and articulate, but that, quote, he seems to freeze whenever a television camera appears, unquote. Rupert also lamented a U.S. populace that can't agree on how serious a threat militant Islam is, and he suggested he has skepticism about the danger of man-made global warming. He said, quote, alleged climate changes, he should be working for the World Bank, and other problems are far more manageable than is the threat of Islamic terror. It's a tragedy that we're not more united in the war on terror, Murdoch said. And then, of course, Laura Bush was on the Today program with Ann Curry this week.
You know the American people are suffering, watching.
Oh, I know that very much. And believe me, no one suffers more than their president. And I do when we watch this. And certainly the commander-in-chief who has asked our military to go into harm's way.
Nobody suffers more than the commander-in-chief, ladies and gentlemen, and his wife. So it all, and of course, there's the persistent threat that the president will veto the war spending bill, which has now been passed by Congress with the deadline, the mandate, the timeline, the benchmarks, the guidelines, the recommendations, the possibilities of troop withdrawal. So it may all be resulting in a phone call next here in Le Show.
Sounds like the bonefish got the better of that deal. Yellow.
Hey, 41, it's me, Mr. Fatigue.
43, how you doing, Sprat? Just got back from Moscow with Bill Clinton for Yeltsin's funeral. Wow, this fella Yeltsin must have drunk more in one weekend and maybe you shouldn't have quit completely. He looked pretty good in there.
Yeah, I bet he couldn't have done a half hour on the stationarial bike at Condi's setting. So, yeah. 41, you have a good time with your surrogatory son?
Talking about Bill? Hey, 43, he's better ex-presidential company than Jimmy Carter. Much choice at this point.
Yeah.
From what a person can see from a distance, you're doing real well pushing back at your Democrat friends on this war deal.
Well, Yeah, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guys, it's important to remind them that vote spelled backwards is veto. And if Harry Reid thinks he can snatch defeat from the jaws of life, you know, he can think twice. This war is far from lost, and it's not going to be lost under my watch, no matter what the Democrats do.
Yeah, it's kind of spunk-like to hear from you.
I mean, it's like Laura told Annie Kerr, nobody suffers more from this war than I do. Do you think Pat Tillman's approval ratings are as low as mine right now? Shoot, I'm the sufferer-in-chief. And your friend, Mr. Tenet, seems to be on a mission to drive those ratings even lower.
I think I told you many's the time when you cross the agency gets cross. Never put it that pithily before, maybe, but got the gist across to you.
I gave the guy the freaking Medal of Freedom, and he goes out and blabs his mouth off?
Yeah.
Should have given him the Medal of Keep Your Yap Shut.
Thought he was pretty loyal about stopping the blowback at your office door.
Yeah, that's right. He only attacked everybody that I chose to give me sound policy advice, and in the Dixter's case, to tell me who to choose. Some folks are going to interpret that as a black-handed compliment at me.
Just never thought it was right to let the agency take the heat for decisions that other folks made. You know, bad for morale. When morale gets bad at the agency, well, don't have a snappy ending for that one, but you get the idea.
Yeah, just taken. Mm. Way I understand it, 41 people who serve at the pleasure of the president shouldn't be in the business of administrating pain to the president.
You could be talking about your friend Senior Gonzalez.
See, that's a racist comment, 41. Just because he's a Latino, that does not make him my senior.
Don't have a racist bone in my body. And really very few racist muscles.
Well,
but 43, how much longer are you going to let your friend pee on your topsiders? He's doing you a lot more harm than George Tenet ever did.
Yeah. Well, sir, all due respect, that's where you're dead in the water wrong.
Mm.
Fredo's been with me since George Tenet was kissing your friend Bill Clinton's hiney for an appointment. Fredo's been more loyal to me than two cockers and a labradoodle.
Mm-hmm.
So, take it from me, we're not even going to think about cutting him loose until second week of June. We owe him that much.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, seems to me like your agency buddy, Mr. Tenet, has been spreading the word that it's dump on the president week.
Well, A, of course, barely know the man. He didn't even give me the company briefings personally. And B, what do you mean?
Couldn't quite help missing the video of you telling Larry King you thought the country had George Bush fatigue.
No.
Unless you were inferentiating that folks are still tired of you 14 years after you got off their TV screens. I think you were referencing to me.
Was. True. Don't think the country's tired of the real you, but they're tired of the old public you. You need a new you. That's why presidents clean house in their second terms, to get a new them.
Not sure I'm going to be taking advice about second terms from a fellow who couldn't win one. And couldn't help noticing your pal, Mr. Murdoch, once he's safely out of the country, criticalizing me for being a less-than-ept communicator. You ever heard Murdoch talk? He sounds like a late crocodile hunter, bless his soul, after four Mai Tais and an Ambien.
Sprout, you're letting your justifiable pride and anger and frustration and sense of deep humiliation get the better of you. Rupert was just making the same point as your dad, coming at it from down under. You need a new communication team. They called Ronald Reagan the great communicator, and even he went and got a new second-term team, and the guy ends up with such a great public image that his name is on airports, and my name is on the Iran-Contra pardon. So
we got a great communication team. Good people working hard every day. Of course, the White House press corps was having a love-in with Tony Snow even before the cancer thing. So maybe there's our problem.
Your problem is you've been reading from the same script for so long, everybody can recite the words along with you. That's a fatigue thing right there.
Well, sir, there was a time when I think you knew this game well enough to know that if you're going to change just for an example, your war policy to send more troops and keep them there longer and stop checking for signs of progress so often, you gotta sound as if you're not changing anything. That's just leadership 1.01.
Listen, Sprout, if you think you're getting it with both barrels for Mr. Tenet's little book tour, wait till Colin's book comes out.
Oh, now, Colin's a good man. He's not gonna... Well, we're leaning pretty hard on him not to.
Leaning on him?
Yeah, let's just say this time the Medal of Freedom is gonna come with a few strings attached.
Well, look, 43, said what I said. Not sorry I said it. Sorry you're angry I said it. Not angry that you're angry.
Okay, got the list of emotions, 41, thanks. Gonna spend the whole weekend focusing on being the new improved George W. Bush. Be more like your new favorite son, Mr. Oral whatever.
Sprout, I only have one favorite son, and he's not a Clinton. Give our love to Laura and tell her we're sorry she's suffering.
Oh, she's fine. Will do. Take care, 41.
You too, 43.
That's what they're selling us. Look sharp, you'll have them a fool. A cool life, that's what they're offering us. Who cares what you think or if you made it through your school? A cool life, your face in magazines. Don't make it look like work. Choose books that may look good on you. And your bespoke shoes and your boat tank shirt, don't you know?
Now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen, Hollywood star Richard Gere, you've probably heard about this. He's ordered arrested by an Indian court for kissing Bollywood star Shilpa Shetty. Can you say that on the air? Shetty? I feel Shetty. Oh, offered on Friday a sincere apology for any offense he caused. His statement came a day after the court issued an arrest warrant against him for allegedly, quote, obscene behavior. For embracing Shetty and planting several kisses on her cheeks, on her face, during an AIDS awareness event earlier this month. He has apologized. Shetty earlier made the news as the winner of Celebrity Big Brother in England. She's out of roll. Marilee Jones, the Dean of Admissions at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, resigned this week for allegedly misrepresenting her credentials. According to a university official, Jones has been an outspoken critic of resume padding. She listed degrees from Albany Medical College, Union College, and Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, but it appears she had no such degrees, according to research by the Boston Globe. She had earlier rewritten MIT's application, trying to get students to reveal more about their personalities and less about the lists of their accomplishments. MIT Chancellor Philip Clay called the situation unfortunate. In a statement, Jones apologized, saying she's, quote, deeply sorry. No evidence. Three sorries. No evidence whether she padded that. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe apologized for the Japanese military's actions in forcing so-called comfort women to work in military brothels during World War II. He said he had deep-hearted sympathies for the women and was sorry for their suffering. This news came out of Camp David. President Bush called the Comfort Women episode a regrettable chapter in the history of the world and said he accepted the Prime Minister's apology. Apparently President Bush spent time as a Comfort Woman. At Dateline Atlanta, two police officers pled guilty to manslaughter in the shooting death of a 92-year-old woman during a botched drug raid last fall. Officer J.R. Smith told a state judge that he regretted what had happened. The war on drugs claims another victim, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry, the 35-year-old said, his voice barely audible. Well, then speak up. He pled guilty to manslaughter, violation of oath, criminal solicitation, making false statements, and perjury, which was based on claims and a warrant. Former officer Greg Junier pleaded guilty to manslaughter, violation of oath, criminal solicitation, and making false statements. Both men are expected to face 10 years in prison. This was a November 21 no-knock drug raid on the home of Catherine Johnson, 92 years old. An informant had described buying drugs from a dealer there. When the officers burst in without warning, Johnson fired at them. And they fired back, killing her. The officers involved in her death fired 39 shots. Dateline Israel reporter Amir Tahari told the Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's spokeswoman that an interview with him published under his name in the German magazine Focus had not been written by him. In the interview, he said that Iran's disputed nuclear program could be severely damaged by firing 1,000 cruise missiles in a 10-day attack. The material published was not what the Prime Minister's office had passed to the magazine, and the editors had removed the story from the website. I apologize to you, said a spokesman for the magazine. Focus. Philadelphia, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin, you know, it's hard, man, apologized. Oh, last week, he criticized the cleanliness of Philadelphia after a visit to the city last week. Last weekend, he apologized for his remarks. The original statement, let me tell you something, you ought to go to Philly and you'll appreciate how clean New Orleans is, Nagin said to a crowd of New Orleans residents concerned about the city's recovery. Just go walk around Philly a little bit and you'll appreciate it, Nagin said. We still have some work to do, but we definitely beat them by the long shot. He struck a different tone when he was in Philadelphia, thanking the city for providing shelter to displaced New Orleanians after the storm. Philadelphia Mayor John Street said Nagin had later apologized. I intended no disrespect to the city of Philadelphia, Nagin said. It's all about respect. From Glenn Cannon, Assistant Administrator in the FEMA Disaster Operations Directorate, dear disaster generalist, an unfortunate administrative processing error at FEMA has resulted in the printing of Social Security numbers on the outside address labels of disaster assistance employee reappointment letters. Everyone affected will get identity theft protection for 1 year free of charge, and each affected employee will receive a personal telephone call apology. So that's an apology to come. CBS Radio is apologizing again. It suspended two New York radio hosts after an Asian American advocacy group complained about a phone prank littered with ethnic and sexual slurs. The call to a Chinese restaurant was played on The Doghouse with JV and Elvis. On April 5th, the day after Don Imus's remarks about Rutgers women's basketball players. The call was replayed a week after CBS fired Imus. Karen Mateo, a spokeswoman for CBS Radio, says the two hosts, JV and Dan Lay, Elvis, were suspended, and Vandegrift, JV, apologized on Monday's show. The skit involved a caller attempting to order fried lice from a Chinese restaurant. That's so fresh. Rapper Kamram, has apologized for comments he made on a news show stating he wouldn't alert police if he knew a serial killer was living next door to him. That was on 60 Minutes, he said he would never snitch on somebody regardless of their crime because it would contradict his code of ethics. You do not want a rapper, ladies and gentlemen, to contradict his code of ethics, because that might mean, you know, less bling. Hi, I'm Les Bling. And today on the show, but no, wait a minute, there's more. There's so much more to Cameron's apology. Got it right here, don't you think? The 31-year-old has now backtracked, insisting he didn't intend for his comments to be offensive. I guess he intended them for to be entertaining. He says, where I come from, once word gets out that you've cooperated with the police, that only makes you a bigger target of criminal violence. That is a dark reality in so many neighborhoods like mine across America. I'm not saying it's right, but it's reality. Looking back now, I can see how those comments could be viewed as offensive, especially to those who have suffered their own personal tragedies. Please understand that I was expressing my own personal frustration at my own personal circumstances. I in no way was intending to be malicious or harmful. I apologize deeply for this error in judgment. You think he wrote that or his lawyer? Just wondering. The Afghan officials have reprimanded British diplomats over a campaign by UK troops in Helmand province telling farmers that growing poppies was understandable and acceptable. This was an error, says Zalmay Afzali, spokesman for the Ministry of Counter-Narcotics. A British military spokesman said the ads were intended to counter Taliban propaganda that British soldiers had moved to the valley in order to destroy farmers' livelihoods. They have to understand that we're here to kill the Taliban, not to cut down their poppy. But the colonel admitted the wording of the message was open to misinterpretation, that after complaints from the local governor, Asadullah Wafa, it was removed and an apology was replaced it. And finally, Hugh Grant has accepted undisclosed damages Friday from a British newspaper publisher over claims about his relationships with former girlfriends Jemima Khan and Elizabeth Hurley. The 46-year-old actor said publisher of the Daily Mail had sued them. He had, in fact, Grant. Grant's lawyer said all the allegations and factual assertions are false. Associated Newspapers apologized to Grant. Oh, and of course, Alec Baldwin apologized for the phone message to his daughter. Enough about that. Now, in the waning moments, news of the warm. China, ladies and gentlemen, may become the world's greatest emitter of greenhouse gases before the end of 2007, says the International Energy Agency's chief economist. But he says that's not the most worrying forecast. By 2030, emissions from China will be growing twice as fast as emissions from all of the European countries combined. And the map of Greenland will have to be withdrawn. A new island has appeared off its coast, suddenly separated from the mainland by the melting of Greenland's enormous ice sheet, a development that is being seen as the most alarming yet sign of global warming. Shaped like a three-fingered hand, some 400 miles south of the Arctic Circle, it had been discovered by a veteran American explorer and Greenland expert who has named it Warming Island. Welcome to Warming Island, where all your warming comes true. News of the Warm, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, just one more reason to come to New Orleans next weekend is the fact that I'll be on stage at the Lanyap stage at Jazz Fest Friday at 4:40, playing occasional bass for Judith Owen in her Jazz Fest debut. Y'all come. But that concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz short wave. In Berlin on the mighty 104, on both XM and Sirius satellite radio. Around the world via the internet on your computer, whatever you want it, live and archived at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download at www.audible.com/theshow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com, even though it doesn't show up there yet. But believe me, it's there. And it would be just like it showing up there if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. By the way, I was in Toronto for a couple of days this week. No, don't pity me. They have both Canadian Idol and American Idol up there. That's Canadian culture. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh and Chicago desks. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. And a tip of the Show chapeau to Bob Master Bob Dunn. He's master of communications here at WWNO New Orleans for helping to make today's show possible. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. Did I say that? Then I said it again. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans, Louisiana.